Greetings from the Church of God's Seventh Day. Shall we stand, please? Our Father, we're so thankful that you are a loving Father and that you provided a way of salvation through your Son, we call Jesus the Christ or Yeshua, and that by accepting him and confessing our sins and receiving forgiveness, we become your children. We're so thankful for that. And we realize that we don't understand everything, don't understand very much, really, according to the Word of God. We see through a mirror darkly. But we do understand that you love us, and your Son loves us, and he died for us. And part of our understanding also is, if you love me, keep my commandments. And so we are Sabbath keepers. We thank you for that day, the day to set aside for you. And now as different churches, different groups from around this part are here to fellowship together in the Sabbath and understand more about the Sabbath, we pray your blessings upon us. May the Holy Spirit in a special way touch each presenter, touch each of us as listeners, as hearers, as participants, that we may grow in knowledge and in truth and be more pleasing unto you. And this we ask in Jesus' name. Amen.
Our first talk this morning is being brought to us by a man who's had many years in different churches of God. He began attending the Radio Church of God, later the Worldwide Church of God, with his parents at age 5 in 1950. He attended Ambassador College in Pasadena, graduating from the Big Sandy campus in 1966. He remained employed by the church and/or college for the next 16 years. He served on the Ambassador College faculty, pastored, founded, and was managing editor of the Worldwide News, a publication for church members. In April 95, he voluntarily left the fellowship of the Worldwide Church of God and has since been a part of the United Church of God. Since his full-time employment with the church ended in 1982, he's been involved principally in higher education and in business, and now heads the Musselman family's $50 million publishing business. He also is editor and publisher of the newspaper In Transition. He's an elder in the United Church of God, married to Alice, who's also here for 29 years, with 3 grown children and 2 grandchildren. So it's my pleasure now to introduce the publisher of In Transition, Mr. John Robinson.
Well, good morning, everyone. It's not often that I get to speak on Sunday morning. But, or even much less on Easter Sunday morning, but it's nice to be here. I was listening to, I guess we're there, some sort of echo or something, listening to Mr. Rhodes introduce me. I wondered how I found time to do all those things, and sometimes I wonder about that. I think we all do. We just wonder how we get through all of the things we'd like to do, and you always end up leaving so many things on the table that you would like to do, research, you'd like to go places and do things, and there's just not enough time. Well, I'd like to thank Mr. Rhodes for the invitation to come and speak to you this morning. I'm honored to be a part of the seminar this weekend that has brought so many of us together. I think it's really wonderful to see different groups that are represented here and people that are willing to put aside some of the doctrinal or other differences that we might have on some points, maybe some of which are not terribly essential, and come together for a greater good. So I really appreciate that. Before I start this morning, I did want to just get some feel for who I'm speaking to. I'm always paranoid as a public speaker to end up talking to a group and not talking about things that they're interested in learning about or hearing about. So if I could, how many of you that are here this morning are a part of the Sacred Names group? Could I just, okay, great. I appreciated the presentation yesterday and look forward to getting better acquainted with your work. How many of you have from the Adventist Church or Adventist background? I know Dr. Bakayoki is here and a couple of others. Great. How many of here from a Church of God Seventh Day? Great. If I could just say something to you gentlemen publicly, and that is I really am very terribly depressed historically at the attitude that the Worldwide Church of God took toward the Church of God Seventh Day, and particularly in regard to the spiritually dead, the Sardis label, And I have, whatever I've come in contact with, Church of God, people tried to say that, the Church of God Seventh Day. My wife, who is sitting here on the front row, grew up, her mother before her was a part of the Church of God Seventh Day in the Oregon area. And many, many years ago, this is not a new thing with me, but say 20 or 25 years ago, in listening to, her name is Bertha Rothery from Portland, Oregon. She's now 91, is it, Alice? 92 years old. And one of her uncles was Arvin Stith. And there is a family tradition that Arvin Stith baptized Herbert Armstrong. And I have never successfully disproved that. I know he was also, or I don't know whether he was baptized twice, but there was a Baptist minister, I believe, that he says in his writings that baptized him. But I came to realize early on that many of the things that we were traditionally, that were presented to us were not always a fair characterization of the actual events. So it's really great to be able to see the Church of God Seventh Day and United and Global and so on be able to share some of these activities. How many of you then are, and I don't know that this is a good way, but how many of you are independents, not formally affiliated with any group? We have, okay. We have all groups here. And then how many of you would have a Worldwide Church of God background? Okay. That's usually the way the last few ones of these that I have been to, there's been certainly almost a preponderance of people that came through the Worldwide Church of God experience. Well, I'm going to be talking about that a little bit later this morning. As Mr. Rhodes explained, I am the publisher of In Transition, and I know that, let me just ask, how many of you are subscribers to In Transition? Oh, my. Oh, thank you. Thank you. That's very, very encouraging. We have been tremendously thrilled with the response. I know sometimes I may be a bit more of a, is there an echo or is there a feedback on here? It bothers me. If it doesn't bother you, I'll try to just block it out of my mind. The paper has been very warmly received, and I appreciate that very much. For those of you who are not familiar with it, it is a tabloid format. And we run 16 pages, and our readers tell us that the type is too small. It's quite small, which means we get an incredible amount of information jammed into these 16 pages. It's a good thing because Sam Bakayoki contributes to us, and his written words are almost as numerous as his spoken words, so we really have to keep the type small. In fact, this issue that is the most frequent, or the newest one, is March the 25th, and we have reprinted in its entirety Dr. Bakayoki's open letter response to Joseph Dukach, Jr. I still call him Jr. just to avoid confusion between him and his father. I think he's dropped the Jr. But I think it was important, and we debated running it in two parts, and I know as a subscriber, I hate to see things come out in parts. I want to get the whole thing right now. But I think that you will find it, if you're not a subscriber, a fairly fair approach to the publishing of news about the Churches of God. We do focus on the offshoots of the Worldwide Church of God. And I'm not saying that that is right. I'm just saying that that has been our first audience that we've tried to reach out to. We have, in this issue, a feature and a list from Alan Ruth, who will be speaking later in the day. Alan and I have gotten acquainted in the last year. And as time goes on and we have the resources, we want to reach further out. I think there are some interesting things that we want to, in time, be able to pick up from the Adventist Church. Trying to help people see some of the similarities. We do try to be just as candid and as impartial in our reporting as we can. But despite that, we periodically are criticized by being too pro-United Church of God. And I always chuckle at that because the United Council of Elders certainly doesn't see it that way. And there are many in the United Church of God, and I'm speaking of my own church affiliation, that would like to see me go away, that would like to see the paper disappear. We're certainly entitled, each of us, to our own opinions. But if we do have a preponderance of news, as it seems from time to time, on the United Church of God. Bear in mind that of all of the offshoots of the Worldwide Church of God to date, they are greater in numbers. And so when you are in the publishing end of things, you do have to listen to your audience. And as you try to reach out and identify and seek new audiences, you do have to serve your current audience. And I don't mean to reduce it all down to simple marketing terms, but I do work in the publishing business, and I do understand the realities of trying to serve your constituency as best you can. So I hope that there's not an undue bias that is there. And again, I expect the composition of the readership to change as time goes on. So I just wanted to say that. There is a group out there that bears no name, and these are the individuals who belong to the patio Church of God, or the living room Church of God, as we say sometimes. They do not formally affiliate, nor do they attend any congregation. And if I have time, I'll try to come back and address this later, but I am very concerned that in all of our groups, whether it be the Church of God Seventh Day or whether it be the Sacred Name Movement, I will say to all of us, to our shame, sometimes we want, as one speaker said yesterday, to see a lot of growth, but we want all of the growth to come from people who are just like us. And one of the problems with that is we have a huge group. We have a group out there that is many times, and I'm speaking now of North America, I'm not speaking internationally. In North America, we have a group of disenfranchised, disassociated individuals who far exceed the number in the United Church of God, the Global Church of God, and the Philadelphia Church of God, all combined. You add them all up, we still have a group out there that's even greater. So when I hear people from my own church or from other churches say, well, the church is now stabilized, we don't need in transition, what a silly name, the church is stable now, I say, I certainly hope that those people out there are still in transition. I hope that those people who are not currently meeting with a group will change and will rethink in the years ahead. So I see this as a medium and a vehicle to at least keep them informed so they at least know what is going on. And we do try to get material in there that will help them and perhaps make life a little bit easier for them. To move on into the topic that I wanted to speak to this morning, when Mr. Rhodes contacted me, we were not terribly precise on the topic, and so he put in the announcement sheet that I would be talking about the Churches of God in transition. I actually, not realizing he had assigned me that title, did kind of narrow that down, and this morning I want to talk, and I hope it's in the spirit of the announcement so you're not disappointed, but I wanted to talk about the role of church government in the Worldwide Church of God, how it developed in the Worldwide Church of God, how it impacted the Church of God Seventh Day and vice versa, and also then how it played out with a lot of the groups that have come along since. A major reason I think that we all can at least agree on, one of the major reasons that so many of us from different backgrounds are here today, one of the triggering events was the doctrinal changes that have come about in the Worldwide Church of God in the past year. There were many people, and I believe that there are still many individuals, I don't know whether they're thousands or tens of thousands, but certainly there are many people that remain in the Worldwide Church of God that are not happy with the doctrinal changes. But because of the issue of church government, they have been told since the time that they were a little child. In my case, I began to attend, as Mr. Rhodes mentioned, the First Feast of Tabernacles in 1950. I was 5 years old. You can figure it out. That makes me 51. I never been embarrassed about my age. Maybe, as someone said, John, you still have your hair, so you can at least talk about that. But even if that goes, we went in 1950, and we all got in the car. I lived in South Texas, and we trekked on across the United States, drove all the way out to Pasadena, which is about a 1,500-mile trip. We were there, and actually my father the first year did not intend to go to the Feast of Tabernacles. In fact, I'm not even sure that he knew about it. As I recall now, I don't think he had just been baptized, he and my mother, on August the 4th. And I don't think that he even knew about it. So he went out, and in those days, the Pasadena congregation just had, you know, maybe 15, 20, 30 people that attended. And we all then, as a result of Mr. Armstrong's persuasive personality, decided, well, we'll go up for part of the Feast of Tabernacles. We'll go on up to Belknap Springs for the Feast of Tabernacles. So we went up there, and by the middle of the feast, Mr. Armstrong had preached anybody who left early into everlasting damnation, I guess. You know, you were going to go to hell. Not that we believe that, but I'm just saying that, you know, boy, how dare you leave early and go home. So we kept the entire feast there. And I remember trying to slip between the sheets at the lodge that we were staying at Belknap Springs as a little boy. And it was so cold. I mean, this is a South Texas boy that had probably never seen a temperature that low in his life, just trying to stay warm. So as a child growing up, you know, very impressionable, early on, I began to understand the impact of church government. Now, not when I was in age five. This came along a little bit later. But I'm just saying, from my youngest days, from the time I was 8 or 9 years old, I have been taught about church government, and many of you in the audience have as well. So I think we need to look at the impact. There are two major issues. One of them is the doctrinal issue, that where, as we feel, the Worldwide Church of God has gone into doctrinal error. But beyond that, why were they so successful at it? I think we want to talk about that this morning and realize that there may be some lessons for all of us in looking at the Worldwide Church of God experience. One of the little stories that I'll tell you began last year in January, late January of 1995. This was a couple of months after the, as some of the humorous critics, trauma in churches always brings out a certain level of gallows humor, I think, that can be entertaining at times. But we were fond of talking about the changes. And one of the humorous things was, well, if you had been going to the Worldwide Church of God 18 months ago, you might have said, as the humorist did, well, Herbert Armstrong was really only right about two things. What were they? Well, tithing and church government, because everything else had pretty well been repudiated by that time. So we say, okay, just those two things. Well, I will say, to the credit of the leaders of the Worldwide Church of God, they have backed off on mandatory tithing. So I think, to be intellectually honest with their package of, as they call it, New Testament religion, or New Covenant religion, that is proper for them to do. But they have hung on to the issue of church government. So now we say the only thing Herbert Armstrong was right about was church government. That is, if you attend the Worldwide Church of God. And some of the other splinter groups also embrace that philosophy. So as this was all going on about a year ago, my wife and I went out to Southern California, and we spent about a week, maybe a little bit less than a week, and we stayed with some friends unfortunately, our relationship is not the same. At the time, we were all attending the Worldwide Church of God, and that relationship has been strained, as so many relationships, just tens of thousands of people have been torn apart in their familial relationships over some of these issues. But we went out, and I was able to spend time with some of the movers and shakers in the new organization. And one of my more memorable conversations was with one of the men who is a principal architect of the new teachings of the Worldwide Church of God. I will not name him because, frankly, it was a private conversation and I was not there as a reporter, and I don't think it's fair for me to talk about his name. But I will tell you what he said. You know, we talked for about an hour, and I asked him questions that I thought would help me understand. I asked him about his conversion experience. You know, how do you look at that now? When did you develop a personal relationship with Jesus Christ? Now, I know when I did, but I asked him, when did you develop a personal relationship with Jesus Christ? Now, this is an individual who is an evangelist in the Worldwide Church of God. And if you're not familiar with the rank system of the Worldwide Church of God, that's way on up there. That's right under apostle. I mean, that is and I don't mean to say I'm tacky, but it is an exalted position in the Worldwide Church of God. This individual said, about 1987, this was a year after Herbert Armstrong died. This individual was probably baptized sometime in the late 50s or early 60s. So bear this in mind. Even though he had been baptized into the Worldwide Church of God, and I don't say that, please don't hold me to those words. I'm just saying he became a member of the Worldwide Church of God, he was baptized, and I know that you're not baptized into an organization. But many, many years later, he believed, he then came to know Jesus Christ. And I found that really surprising, because that is not the experience of most of the people that are here today. There was a time that you came to know Jesus Christ. And in talking about that, we talked about his view toward Christmas and Easter and various other things. I said, after an hour or so, and I called him by name, how can you believe all of these things that we've just talked about and yet cling to the teaching of church government? And he paused for a minute, and he smiled, and he said, "Ah, John, because it is so effective in helping us teach the new doctrines. So don't fall into this thought process that somehow or the other they just haven't gotten around to fixing this. The leadership of the Worldwide Church of God understands the power of the teaching on church government as a way to reach into people and to change their thinking." And I want to talk about that today, because in many of the offshoots of the Worldwide Church of God, there are varying degrees of agreement and disagreement on the subject of church government. So what I propose to do, and incidentally, because of the sake of time today, and I want to be sure that Mr. Rhodes, what time do we begin the question and answer? I'm a little bit off. In 15 minutes, I have another 15 minutes to speak. Is that correct? And then we go to the Q&A.
Everything, including the questions, should be over in 40 minutes from
now. Okay.
It's up to you how you want.
Okay, well, I'll just refer then to Dr. Bakayoki's article. Sam, I want to publicly thank you for particularly one section of your letter, and that is that addresses the church government issue and points to the obvious. Sam does not use this word hypocrisy, and maybe I shouldn't either, but let's call it a dichotomy between what is taught in terms of New Testament understanding and the representation of the doctrinal package of the Worldwide Church of God and clinging to something that is reminiscent of the Levitical priesthood, and Sam talks about the succession issue. So read that on your own, but it is very powerful, and it does address some of the issues that I don't have time to cover this morning. There is another book that, again, I'm going to refer to and just mention a couple of things from a historical perspective, and I invite Dr. Bakayoki and others during our Q&A session, if I have misspoken on any of these issues, to please clarify it. I'm here in a pursuit of an intellectually honest approach to things. But there is a book called Will the Real Heretics Please Stand Up? It is a self-published book. I met the gentleman almost 10 years ago in the late 1980s. I was living in Texas, and we had a typesetting business, and he was looking for someone to typeset his book. He had it on a computer disk, and I worked with him on it at the time. But in his book, in which he addresses the historical aspects of the early New Testament church, and then we come along to later centuries, and you see the influence of Constantine and later of Augustine and so on. He talks about the early New Testament church and how different it is from mainstream Protestantism today. He talks about four things that was able to protect the early New Testament church. One was that there was no special revelation. I will not dwell on that. Secondly, that they remained separate from the world, and then only later did, in the time of Constantine, where the state got involved, some of the issues that Mr. Wiedenheff talked to yesterday, the separation from the world. The third was their practice of voluntary referral of doctrinal matters, policy matters, to those churches where the apostles had personally taught as a way of staying in sync and in harmony with the early apostolic church. And then number four was congregational independence. The independence of each congregation made it difficult, and I'm quoting from, I guess I didn't say the author's name, David Berceau. It's spelled unusually, it's B-E-R-C-O-T. He's an attorney from Henderson, Texas. At least that's where he was living when I knew him. The fourth point, he says, is congregational independence, and I quote, "The independence of each congregation made it difficult for any erroneous teachings to spread quickly through the church." And he makes the point that these last two things, the voluntary referral to the churches that were pastored and where the original apostles had been, and then this congregational independence. He said that Constantine was able to batter down those last two remaining walls of protection against the church by the Council of Nicaea. And he makes a big point that when you allow a super organization to come in, then you are able to pervert a church very quickly. When there is independence and divergence and difference, the doctrinal integrity can maintain itself for many, many years. But when you bring everything under one umbrella, you can then infiltrate, permeate, and absolutely destroy the church quickly. I would not have believed 10 years ago, certainly not 20 years ago, and way, way not 30 years ago, the speed with which you can take an individual who one year says, I am willing to die for what I believe in, and then have him one year later going out this very morning and participating in an Easter sunrise service. As you know, some of our former brethren of a year ago are now out celebrating Easter sunrise services, or at Easter sunrise services this morning. I'm not here to criticize or to condemn. I'm here to say this can happen very quickly. So let's talk about that. How did the Worldwide Church of God start out? And I have far more material than I can cover this morning, but I will refer you to a book that is out on the tables this morning. It's called The Early Writings of Herbert W. Armstrong. These are the public domain articles written from 1928 to 1953. A very fine gentleman named Richard Nichols has done a tremendous labor of love in going back and getting into an electronic format and then publishing this. It's available on disc, I think it's IBM format. I don't know that he has a Macintosh format. But you can either get it on disc or you can get a hardback version. There is no charge for it. I would say, and I probably would embarrass Richard if he were here, Richard is not independently wealthy, and I would encourage you, if you are benefited by these things, to contribute at least something. Because, as you can imagine, it's not free to produce a book like this. But what he has done is gone back and taken those things that were in the public domain. I do not believe that Richard eulogizes Herbert Armstrong. In fact, he's very critical of him in many, many, many points. But he does go back and address the writings of Herbert Armstrong in the late 1920s, the 30s, and into the 40s, the 50s. I think some of the writings here go on into the 1950s. Maybe not. No, I got 1953, it says on the cover of the book. And one of the articles that that Mr. Armstrong wrote early on that appears in here was his 1938 article on how the church was to be organized. And I would encourage you to read it. It is a far different Herbert Armstrong than wrote about the issues in the 1970s and the 1980s. Far different. And I'll tell you a little story, because sometimes you find yourself really in a catch-22 on some of these issues. But many years ago, one of the now leaders of one of the offshoots of the Church of God, I reported to him for a brief period. And this individual said to me, as I guess it was expected to be a profession of faith, you know, John, do you believe that Herbert W. Armstrong is an apostle of God? And I was a church pastor at the time. And I said, I don't have any problem saying that Mr. Armstrong is my boss. I have no problem saying that he is my employer. I have no problem calling him the pastor general of the Worldwide Church of God. I don't know that I am comfortable calling him an apostle. Oh, you know, you would have thought I was a heretic. You know, my next stop would be at the offering of Molech to sacrifice one of my children. And the individual was terribly concerned and frustrated. He wanted some profession that was not adequate. And so he said, well, can you call him God's anointed? And I thought to myself, I didn't share this with the individual, I thought, where does that term God's anointed come from? Anybody know the first time someone in the Bible was called God's anointed? I think the answer will intrigue you. It was Saul. So, I have no problem with that. And now wait a minute. wait a minute. You're putting words into my mouth. I say that in the sense of the word. that being God's anointed does not necessarily imply infallibility. Is that a nice way to say it? And so therefore, I have no problem with that. God has used many different people. And you know the really old, I mean, it's so old, I laughed about that when I was in my crib about Balaam's ass. You know, God can use animals to do things. Christ said that as he was entering into Jerusalem, he said, you know, the disciples were concerned about them cutting the palm fronds and putting them down. And he said, look, if they don't do this, then my Father will raise up stones. And I'm probably not quoting it very well, but you understand the spirit of that example there. So through this process, you know, we've had a tremendous desire to revert back into this title of apostle, or Mr. Armstrong later on called himself the sole apostle of the 20th century. I do not believe that. I did not believe it when he was saying it, and I of course do not believe it now. I mean, the impact, the ramification of that is just mind-boggling. So through this process, I went back and I looked. And to tie this story together, I said to this evangelist at the time who was grilling me, interrogating me, I said, you know, the problem I have is I have read not all, but most of Herbert Armstrong's writings. And I found in many cases his early writings to be more compelling than his later writings. So where does this leave me? You know, when somebody that I respect writes on both sides of the issue, I believe it is left for me to sort through and to try to figure out which one was he right on. Because Mr. Armstrong wrote absolutely diametrically contradictory material on the issue of church government, the organization of local churches. And I want to just submit to you this morning, I won't take the time to read every last scrap here because we'd be here till midnight, but there is absolutely powerful evidence in his early writings about what he thought on this issue, and you don't need to remain uninformed. If you are not informed on these issues, I would encourage you to read. Actually, get the book. It'll just take you a few minutes. Read that 1938 article and see if he puts forth a compelling case on the subject, and then evaluate. Because, ladies and gentlemen, I grew up in the Worldwide Church of God, and I mentioned to you earlier, even going back to 1950, I had the blessing of little children at Beltnap Springs. I was 5 years old at the time, as I mentioned earlier, and I stood on a chair. Back in those days, you know, the people were just coming into the affiliation of the Worldwide Church of God. It was a radio church of God. And so at the Feast of Tabernacles, if you didn't have a local congregation to attend, then this was an opportunity to have some of these ceremonies. And I stood on a metal folding chair, and Mr. Armstrong laid hands on me and blessed me. I had coffee with him one morning. He was sitting there having coffee by himself, and I was able to sit down, and I talked to him. And this is kind of a humorous note. He had said in a sermon a couple days before about how we shouldn't drink so much coffee. He talked a lot about health foods in those days. And he said the ideal is one cup of coffee. And, of course, I sat there and watched him drink three cups of coffee for breakfast. But, you know, it was lost on me because, you know, I had tried coffee one time, and it was a terrible experience for a boy of 4 or 5 years old. So all of that was lost on me. Now I don't want to give up my coffee. So now I understand. But the point was, you had that kind of access. You could just go up and talk to him about things. And I'm not suggesting that that was commonplace later on, but our first worldwide or radio Church of God congregation in South Texas was established in 1954. And Raymond Cole, who is now involved in one of the church, is it the Church of the Great God? I'm not Eternal. The Church of God of the Eternal. He was our first pastor. He baptized my parents. He and Myra, Raymond and Myra, were frequent guests in our homes. We called them Raymond and Myra. I mean, I was, by that time, I'd have been 9 years old. Hi, Raymond, how you doing? Myra, you know, it's good to see you. Then Raymond's brother, Wayne, came and pastored the church, Wayne and Doris, and we called them Wayne and Doris, and now I'm into the 1955, 56 era. And it was about this time, in the mid-1950s, and if you go back and look at the Good News magazines, which, again, I don't have time to do, I have a bound volume here. of all of the Good News magazines from 1951 through 1960. I've got the whole set, but I happened to bring this volume. You go back and you realize that in those watershed years of the early 1950s, I didn't understand it as a little boy growing up in the church. I didn't understand what was going on. I just knew things began to change. And not until recent years, when I was able to go back and look at that history as an adult, was I able to really understand not only the impact on the local congregation, but what was going on at Pasadena, California, that then finally filtered its way out to our local congregations. I mean, I'm here to say that in the early days of the Worldwide Church of God, the men came to services in khakis and casual clothes. They were not suits. You go to Worldwide Church of God, well, maybe not today. I don't know. I haven't been in a while. But say 5 years ago, the men would have suits on, the women wouldn't wear pants, and I'm not here to address the theology of that. I'm just saying that was a custom, but that was not the custom in the early 50s. And there was an informality. These were young ministers. I don't know how old Raymond and Myra were at the time. I suspect they were in their mid-20s when they first came out to service. And Raymond and Doris were in their early 20s at the time. They came out. Well, as a little boy who had grown up in that environment, I began to notice, whoops, the pastor said we now need to start and call him Mr. and Mrs. And I got in trouble. And I don't know whether Doris Cole would remember this or not. If she were here, I'd probably terribly embarrass her. But I said, made some comment, and I got really thoroughly rebuked by Wayne later on that we were to, Mr. Armstrong was teaching the young ministers to show respect to the ministry. So many of these things began to change. And what was driving it was you had, and I will say very clearly, this is my personal read on it. And knowing the people, I know Herman Hay, I know Rod Meredith, I know many of the players that came along. I know Ted Armstrong. I think I can say I know him real well. And what happened is Ted was off in the Navy, and he was a disappointment to his father. Richard Armstrong, one of the most decent individuals I ever met to that time in my life, he died when I was about 13, a really wonderful, decent person. I really say that. You don't hear much about Dick anymore. But Dick was never the flamboyant personality. Dick would have never done radio and television in the same way that Ted would have. And so you have an environment where here is Mr. Armstrong, about my age now, in his early to mid-50s. He comes along. He is not only the mentor of these individuals, he is the spiritual leader. And I taught at the university for 7 years at a state university, and before that I taught many years at Ambassador College. And I know firsthand that there is a certain zeal and a certain passion among 18 and 19-year-olds. You know, we say that the best soldiers in the world are the 18-year-olds. They get whipped up into the romance of war, and they're willing to go out and do anything. And so we have these young men who come to Ambassador College. They have this authority figure that is there, Herbert W. Armstrong. And to that point, you do not see in Mr. Armstrong's writings, and I don't know, because I did not know him personally in the same way, but I suspect that there was a very important, a seminal change in his approach to things during that period of time, because he had had limited success up to that point. Quite frankly, you go back and look at his prophecies about what was going on during the Second World War. He said, hey guys, don't even think about this guy Hitler. Look at Mussolini. Mussolini's the guy. And forget Hitler. Nothing's going to become of Hitler. Well, then later on it became obvious that Hitler was much more of a factor than Mussolini. So he said, well, okay, and now it's Hitler. And he stayed on the theme of Adolf Hitler until the mid-1950s. I mean, the Russians knew Hitler was dead, but they didn't bother to share that with the Americans. And so there was some uncertainty in this country, and we had the Police Gazette and all these things about, Adolf Hiitler may be alive, and where was he hiding? Argentina, wasn't it? He's supposed to be in Argentina. So we went through all those things. So there was a certain loss of credibility that Mr. Armstrong had in the late 40s, in the post-World War II era. He comes down to Pasadena. He's thrown into an environment with these young men who want passionately to do great things. They're involved in the romance of religion, a godly mission to go out. And I don't say it in a critical way. I say it in a way to help us to understand what the dynamics of what was going on. And these individuals began to tell Mr. Armstrong that he was great. Now, you can read in the Good News about the first time the word apostle was applied to Herbert Armstrong. It was during Herman Hayes' unapproved sermon at Belknap Springs, or maybe it was Cedar Springs. And he said, you know, Mr. Armstrong is an apostle. Mr. Armstrong thought, well, I guess I am. And then over the next 20 years, we see more and more of a movement toward that level of authority. Again, it is a fascinating story, an absolutely fascinating story of what went on in 53, 54, 55. That was when the core beliefs that caused the Worldwide Church of God to have its exclusivity, all of that was born in that period of time. The 19-year time cycles, the place of safety, the fact that we should not share our church literature with others. You know, the good news is not to be shown to the unwashed. You could not come to church if you were smoking. You could not come to church if you were not ready for baptism and so on. So these things took place. So it picked up speed, by the end of the 1960s, we had congregations where people were terribly passionate about, everybody was Mr. I mean, there were actually ministers' wives who claimed to call their own husbands Mr. in the bedroom. I mean, it was that level of passion about the authority issues. And you know, there was an apostle and there were an evangelist and pastors and preaching elders and local elders and local elders. You know, several of those ranks are not scriptural. We cannot defend those out of the Bible, and yet those were layers of administrative structure. So that, in a nutshell, is how it got started in the Worldwide Church of God. And along the line, there was discrediting of the Church of God Seventh Day. You guys were Sardis. You were spiritually dead. And you know, how many people look into Revelation 2 and 3 and decide that they're Laodicea? I mean, everybody wants to be Philadelphia. You know, it just is. I mean, that's it just makes sense. And so then we've got to fit everybody else into those little packages. So anyway, I do want to just touch on those things and maybe just make a couple of comments. Everything held together in the Worldwide Church of God pretty well until 1974. And the Associated Churches of God. Alan Ruth may be going to talk about some of these things this afternoon. Are you, Alan? So I won't dwell on that. He can talk to you about it if he has time or has the inclination. The Associated Churches of God were not particularly successful, and I don't say that to be critical. They started out with 3,000 or 4,000 people and dwindled fairly rapidly. I was talking to Dick Wiedenheft yesterday and just asking him, you know, as a historian, not as a critic of it. And he had some very intriguing things to say about why it was not more successful. 4 years later, then, Herbert Armstrong fires his son, Garner Ted, and we have this double bind that everybody who leaves the Worldwide Church of God has to do. You have to go through your first year explaining why you left. And Ted Armstrong had said, the only way I'll ever be out of this church is carried out feet first. You know, I will never lift my hand against God's anointed, God's apostle. And he would say it very tearfully and very emotionally. And I believe sincerely. All of a sudden, he's thrown out, so what does he do? Well, he has to come to grips with that issue of how can he go out and do something separate from the one true church. So gradually, the wedge began to come in on the Worldwide Church of God, where not everybody thought that if you were outside the Worldwide Church of God, were you not pleasing to God. Remember, I said earlier that our attitude toward the Church of God Seventh Day, this was one good thing about the Church of God Seventh Day and its offshoots was, well, if there are any Christians out there, there would be a few that are not completely spiritually dead. You know, there are just a few out there that are kind of hanging on and God's merciful to them and so on. But we pretty much excluded everybody else out of that. So gradually, Garner Ted Armstrong came along. And I will say, and those people who have known me many years can attest to that, quite frankly, I never believed that the Brethren of the Church of God International were satanic or, you know, were not part of the Church of God. I realize that in our own congregations, I'm sure Dr. Bakayoki would say not everyone who meets with him in the Adventist Church is necessarily a Christian, as God would judge, because we don't know. God judges whether someone is in his church or not. So in the same way that we, you know, I don't know that everybody in United or everybody in Global, I certainly would think probably not. There are some people maybe that are there for different reasons. But having said that, is to realize that it was only in those late 1970s that people gradually began to think, well, maybe there are other people out there. And we come along into the early 80s, and Gerald Flurry and the Philadelphia Church of God came along. Now, one thing about the Philadelphia Church of God, and if there are any of you here today who are with the Philadelphia Church of God, I say it to present material objectively, they feel very exclusive, and they feel that if we are not of them, you know, that we're probably going to burn in the lake of fire. And I have been to dinner with members of that group and have asked them, I hope in a nice and respectful way, you know, what would happen to family members in their own family, what resurrection would they come up in, and you get a real scary kind of glazed eyes silence over it. So there are still some groups that feel that they are the only ones, but we have been able to move forward away from that and to realize, and I'm speaking now of those people, those of us that came out of the Worldwide Church of God, that there are other people out there. Now, in my concluding remarks, a few days before the conference began this past November. Incidentally, if somebody's going to ask me, my father did write a book called Herbert Armstrong's Tangled Web. I am his son. And I get sometimes a couple of those on the email during the week, but that is correct. He died this past November. But what I was going to say is, in Indianapolis, the leaders that formed the United Church of God did not talk about trying to clone Pasadena. They avoided judiciously the word headquarters. They called it the home office. The home office is there to serve. They have said that it's just fine for congregations to be independently incorporated, to collect tithes and offerings, and they certainly are starting out on the right foot. Now, what the history will be, one of my fears, friends and brethren, is that there is a natural change in organizations and persons directly related to their level of success. When Herbert Armstrong started out, he was very humble and he was very egalitarian, if I can use that word in a good way. And then later on, he became more and more autocratic until he became the sole apostle of the 20th century. I don't know the Adventist history in the same way. Maybe others of you can talk about that. But there is a natural tendency for organizations to become less and less democratic as they move forward. Unless there is a passion on a grassroots level of the church not to allow that to happen. And I would say to all of us here today, many of you, I think, are affiliated with the United Church of God or United Church of God members. And I hope we never lose sight of how the United Church of God started. It was a grassroots movement. There was no individual that made that happen. The Spirit of God moved in the hearts and minds of people all over the face of the earth and brought them to similar convictions. People sitting side by side in congregations of the Worldwide Church of God, not talking to each other because they were forbidden by the pastor to talk against the new teachings. They quietly sat there and they listened and they internalized and they came completely independently of each other to a decision to no longer continue in that fellowship. I've talked to these people. Some of them ran into each other at Safeway and said, "Where are you? Well, I see you at church this week." "No, I've decided not to attend any longer." "You're kidding. I came to that conclusion this week too." "What are you going to do?" "I don't know." "Well, would you like to come over to my house?" And all of a sudden, we've got a dozen people there. That's how the United Church of God got started. And if we lose sight of that and we roll over into some super organization, brethren, I wonder how many years it will be before we are in a position to once again be easily perverted and destroyed. If I sound passionate about it, it's because I am. I'm not here trying to lobby or anything. But I think we really must learn the lessons of the abuses of church government and come to an intellectually honest opinion through a study of the Scriptures about what the Scriptures say on that subject. What do I do now? Did you get this?
The microphone.
Hi. Thank you very much for your very, very insightful and interesting talk. A question about Mr. Armstrong's writings and pronouncements on prophecy and world events in the 1940s and early 50s. I know that he made a lot of mistakes during World War II and so forth. Myself, I deal with reproducible evidence in the historical and comparative politics, international politics field. I work for a project at the University of Michigan that we deal with reproducible evidence dealing with war and conflict and various national attributes from 1816 till the present. And so I have perspectives on things that may happen prophetically myself, but being a believer in using reproducible evidence, I try to calm myself down. So my question is, with Mr. Armstrong, you know, certainly not being an academic, and even if he were, many academics can, you know, become very excited and so forth and lay a hold of things. Mm-hmm. Do you believe, did he say in his prophetical writings in World War II and so forth that he was given like a special revelation from God, or do you think that he was simply being exuberant? I know all of us here probably want to see Christ return, and we can very easily latch on to things and saying, aha, it's going to be very, very, very quick, a year or two, and, you know, just, you know, become excited like that. And I perhaps that he was...
Could I? I'm not sure I follow the question. Is the question, was he just exuberant, or did he claim to have a special insight from God?
Right, in a nutshell, sure.
Let me address it just merely as a longtime observer. Mr. Armstrong came out of an advertising background. I said this to Ted Armstrong one time. I said, you know, and this was in a public meeting, I said, you and your father are given to hyperbole. And he said, we're given to super hyperbole. You know, I mean, it's a true story. So, yes, absolutely. Garner Ted Armstrong and his father are given to super hyperbole. I have that's the testimony of their own family. Having said that, I do think that he is left with many statements. He said in the radio in the early 1950s that if these events that he was saying didn't come to pass in 20 years, that you would know he was a windbag. And there are so many things that he has said that he's hoisted on his own petard, if I can say that. He's written so many things and said so many things that there are, and I'm being intellectually honest with you, many embarrassing statements that he made. And did he claim in the same way that, who's the guy in Tulsa that God whispers in his ear and calls him by name? Oral Roberts, you know, tells him he's going to kill him if he doesn't raise $7 billion and so on. I don't think that the Worldwide Church of God, and I don't think our background was ever such that he claimed that he had a vision or God told him that, but he certainly said that God led him to that understanding. So, again, I'm not trying to be hard on Mr. Armstrong at all. I'm just saying that the evidence is there that he did. I don't. To me, it's not productive to get into discussion whether so-and-so is a false prophet. How many false prophecies does it take to make a false prophet? You know, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin? I'm sorry, I don't know how to do that. Let's move along real quickly with these questions if we can. And let me just ask, could we try to keep these moving along fairly fast and maybe some questions rather than necessarily long comments? Yes, sir.
Basically, I wanted to say that confirm what you said about when people are successful, human nature tends to mm-hmm. this type of stuff.
Yes.
Because we have seen this happen within our movement. Mm-hmm. You have Bill Hawkins, which is a former deacon in the Worldwide Church of God, who is very exclusive. He's the only voice that can hear from mm-hmm. Yahweh, and this type of thing. And you also have Jacob O'Meyer, which is very similar to Herbert W. Armstrong's movement.
Yes.
Started out humble, and then he has went totally exclusive and believes that he's the only person that can give doctrine to the body of Messiah. And so I just wanted to say this is not something that's exclusive to the Worldwide. I think the Worldwide had influence on him because Worldwiders came into the Assemblies of Yahweh in Bethel, which were Jacob O'Meyer, and also with Bill Hawkins, I think there were Worldwiders that broke off and went into that. So I think they had an influence, you know, over that. But these same types of things have happened over and over again.
I appreciate that validation. Again, with so many of these issues, we're talking about human nature. You know, we're not talking about a disease unique to any one organization. I mean, we tend to be that way as people. Yes, sir.
Yes, Mr. Robinson, I'd like to ask a question about the In Transition. And I noticed that each month you're focusing on a new fold or fellowship. And I was wondering, do they send information to you, other small groups, or do you have to go research information from them?
It works both ways. I don't know that there's any formula. We sometimes appreciate help from wherever we can get it. And sometimes we are able to take material that these individuals have sent us. Other times we have to pull it together. Particularly at first, some of the groups were a little bit suspicious of us. Right? You know, some of them still are. But I think as we lay down a track record of being intellectually honest and fair to the best of our abilities, I think some of that will go away. Appreciate the question.
In the latest issue that I've seen, there's an article about you having asked for the details of the top salaries in each of several groups.
That's correct.
And none are reported, I believe.
That's correct.
There didn't seem to be any editorial comment on that, and similar issues sometimes leave us to conclude editorial comments ourselves. I'm wondering if we can expect editorial comment on the reasonability of that sort of thing.
Well, do you want us to emulate the America's Eastern Establishment Press and slip in commentary and little digs?
I think there's room for fair comment.
This is a very difficult area, and to this point, I think we have chosen not to get into editorial comment. We may at some time. I don't want to fall into the criticism, which some could think would be very fair criticism, that this was a publication that I started so I could influence events or try to reach people and so on. We try to report the news, and I don't think it is bad to let God's people draw their own conclusions. I have great faith in, despite the O.J. Simpson trial, I think that for the most part, the American criminal justice system has worked pretty well the last few hundred years. I think you're going to get me started here on some constitutional issues. I do believe that in the United States, and I'm not familiar with the UK in the same way, that First Amendment, the right of fair speech or free speech, is also tied in with what? What are the two guarantees in that First Amendment? Freedom of the press and what? Freedom of religion. So I believe in a free press, and I believe that if a church claims that it is going to be open and is going to be a representative form of government, and let's just talk for just a second about the United Church of God, that is how the United Church of God has characterized itself. It is, you know, the elders got together, they elected and so on. So they're saying we are a representative form of government. And I think, looking back, God has used many kinds of governments over the years to do things, and so I don't know that I'd want to get into the argument about which one's best. What United's done, it's a very workable thing. It'll work just fine. But they need to be true to what they're saying. They can't claim to be open and then say, well, nobody asked. I mean, quite frankly, I was very disappointed in my own church over their failure to be forthcoming in that matter. But, hey, we're all learning. And I like to think that that they will grow in their understanding and understand how to be true to those original commitments. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I've got a question too. But can I just ask at this point, if all the questioners today could try and keep their question down to just 1 minute, I think it should be possible to ask a question in a minute. And I'll set an example here, okay? Without naming names, you mentioned earlier that there are some in United that would like to see In Transition closed down. Could you elaborate and tell us exactly why?
Well, because the United Kingdom is a long ways away, let me pick on somebody who is, you want, it's nobody in the room here. I got an electronic mail from a pastor's wife in the United Kingdom. And the pastor's wife said, well, I was talking to Sister So-and-so at church today, and I can't speak for the other churches represented here, but I do understand the Worldwide Church of God ministry really, really well, really, really well. I was one of them, you know, I'm still an elder, and so I know how they think. And a lot of times you have a question, but you don't want to say it's your question, but Sister so-and-so or Brother so-and-so asked the question. So the question was, don't you think it's time to go quarterly, change the name, the church is no longer in transition, and wouldn't it be best if you just kind of went away? And I think I mentioned earlier that the church is still in transition. United is in transition, global and so on. And I don't know in the same way about the church. I believe the Church of God Seventh Day is the same way. Someone said that you're still wrestling with some of the issues with the Spanish-speaking brethren. So, hey, it's the nature of the church. This is not an admission of failure. This is the nature of the church. It changes. Yes, sir.
I want to not make a question, but make a one-minute comment, because I have a bit different perspective. Although I spent some time at, quote, headquarters in Pasadena as a campus physician, most of the time I was out in a small town in Minnesota, so where I must say when I came into the Worldwide Church of God, before I came in, I took Herbert Armstrong at his word, and I searched the scriptures to try to prove a Sabbath. And once I had that, I contacted all the Sabbath organizations I could find. And as a result, since the late 60s, I've been in contact with Assemblies of Yahweh, Church of God Seventh Day, Seventh-day Adventists, and I've read their literature. And that's been important to me all along, because I never did believe that Worldwide Church of God was the only church, because I could read about other converted people. And I think it's real important in your publication to have a publication that makes sure that people understand that God is working in different ways in different organizations. And I think it's also important for all of us to read other churches or assemblies' literature to know what's going on and give us a bigger perspective, because that's helped me out a great deal through 27 years or so in the Worldwide Church of God to realize that they never were the only Church of God. They never were exclusive, and I never did believe that, and it really helped me out a lot. So I want to give a different perspective that a lot of us who came in never did buy into that. A lot of us never were abused by ministers. A lot of us never did have to call a minister by Mr. We call him by the first name. So there were quite a number of people who had a different perspective in the Worldwide Church of God.
Dr. Barrett, have you ever been told you're a man ahead of your time? I would say that, and I would also... I know numerically I agree with you, but I would wonder what percentage of the membership of the Worldwide Church of God would have shared your view on that. It may not have been a high percentage. Yes, you know, out of the 120, or I think, didn't Worldwide Church of God attendance get up to 150,000 or something like that at one time? So, yes, there would have been thousands of people who shared your vision and your perception of it, but I don't know what that percentage would have been. It would probably have varied from area to area. Because there are great differences from congregation to congregation, as we realize, because of the impact of the minister that's there. Should I leave now? Am I? Okay. Hey, it's great to, I love doing things like this, and I appreciate your attention and your kind questions. And, let me put in, I have not learned from Samuel Bakayoki well enough yet. He sells his books when he's here. Well, did you do that this time? Did you have a show special this time?
Yeah.
No, sir. I'm afraid Mr. Rhodes will drag me out. What I was going to say is Alice and I, my wife and I, will sit out at one of the tables here whenever this next session is over. We have a lunch break, I believe. And if you would like some back issues, I brought a bunch of them up in the car. So if you would like to get a little better understanding of it. And we'll try to come up with some sort of show special if you do want to subscribe.